No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a conversation about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Today we have a special guest, a guy that I've been following for years. His name is Mark Fisher. He's an associate editor at the Washington Post. Mark has been a columnist for years at the Post, and he's now an associate editor and was moved to the opinions page in our opinion section in 2024. After 37 years, he's written several interesting books. Trump Revealed, he's the co-author of that book. And also Something in the Air, which I'm dying to read. I have to talk to him about this because my mom was a radio host in the 50s and 60s, and it's subtitled Radio Rock and the Revolution That Shaped a Generation, and it certainly did. I also want to point out that Mark was part of a Pulitzer Prize winning team for public service in 2014 at the Post. So thanks so much for being with us, Mark. I really appreciate it.
Sure, it's great to be with you.
Let's first talk about the 800-pound gorilla in the room. I was a Washington Post newspaper boy when I was 12, first job I ever had. I've been reading the Washington Post, I got to be honest with you, probably for the first 10 years, comics only, but I've been reading the Washington Post ever since then, and was seriously disappointed to find out that the Washington Post, for the first time in 44 years, has decided not to endorse for the presidential election. So let's talk about that. Can you explain that to us?
Sure, and the first thing I would say is that although it's the Washington Post that's not endorsing anyone for president, it's really not the Washington Post that decided that. It's its owner, Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, who bought the Post 11 years ago and had stayed entirely out of our editorial and news business for all these years, as he had promised to do. The very first time he met with people at the Post, with the staff, he said, I'm not going to know your names, I'm not going to be here, I'm not going to be involved with your news decisions, that's entirely your business. And, you know, he wanted to devote himself to the technical side of our web operations, as well as to the business side of trying to figure out how to make a profit and create a new business model in the wreckage that is today's American news infrastructure. And I have to say that he's been good to his word, and you won't find anyone at the Post who said that Jeff Bezos has in any way interfered with our news coverage, even when we've been extremely critical of his operations elsewhere, his Amazon and his space operations, all of his various businesses. So what happened that changed? Well, last week he informed the top editor on the opinion side, like other newspapers, the Washington Post has a news section and it has an opinion section, and they're separate staffs, they have separate corporate reporting hierarchies, and they set separate computer systems, so they really have nothing to do with each other. On the opinion side, there is this tradition of doing endorsements, and the people who do the endorsements are the editorial board, who are editors and writers. And they make that decision. They decided that they wanted to endorse Kamala Harris. They wrote an editorial. It was scheduled to be published. And then Bezos swooped in last Thursday and informed the editors that there would not be an endorsement. Now, that is his right as the owner. It's his paper, and the editorial board's and the opinion editor pushed back hard, and they said this would be catastrophic to our reputation. It would result in the loss of a great many subscriptions, and it would diminish our credibility. And it's interesting that that was the argument, because Bezos's argument was that editorials that endorse a presidential candidate undermine our credibility. They make they confuse readers into thinking that the opinion of the editorial board is also the opinion of the news reporters and editors. So that's where we are. As everyone has heard and read, we've lost many thousands of subscribers as a result. By some reports, as many as 250,000, which would be about 10% of the total. And there's a great deal of unhappiness within the Post, people who feel that this controversy has undermined our credibility as well as diminished our ability to financially support the work that we do. There's a great deal of worry that this will lead to layoffs and buyouts and cutbacks, and so the people who are dropping their subscriptions would be essentially diminishing the ability of the Post to hold politicians and others, powerful people, to account. So there's a great deal of dismay about that. Bezos wrote a piece defending his decision. Don't think it persuaded a whole lot of people that he did the right thing. There's a very good argument to be made against endorsements, but to make that decision on the eve of an election is clearly devastating and raises big questions about why he really did it and whether his close ties to government contracts, his dependence on government contracts for the profits of his other operations is really what's behind his decision.
Well, first of all, let me say that I admire you for coming on and speaking truthfully to this, and I admire the people of the editorial staff who have resigned. You know, I've had 21 pieces printed on your paper on the opinion page since I've been elected, and although I have problems with the way the Post covers our issue, which is statehood, I've always admired the fact that the people at the Post have given me the access to voice an opinion on my particular issue. And yes, I think that we all understand that when Bezos says it confuses the voters, I think we understand two things. That a lot of people don't think voters in America are very smart. I disagree with that. And number two, that we all understand that the Washington Post makes more money from the federal government than any other newspaper in America because of the notices and other things that are required under federal law that are always printed in the paper. And thirdly, we understand that Donald Trump has been out there threatening to take retribution against anybody that stands against him, and we certainly understand that as well. I wrote a piece one time that said, you know, I've been a campaigner for 40 years. Actually, your first endorsement, I worked for Jimmy Carter. His re-election in 1980, didn't do a good job, but I worked hard for it. And I wrote a piece saying that "I am your retribution" is not a campaign slogan; it's a threat. So we understand that. I think it's also very coincidental, not coincidental, that the only two papers that haven't endorsed are both owned by billionaires. Mr. Bezos is worth $208 billion, and Patrick Sonsong, who owns the L.A. Times, is just a little billionaire. He's only worth $7.2 billion, but still.
Go
ahead.
That's certainly true about the Washington Post and the L.A. Times, but there are many other newspapers that have gotten out of the endorsement business in recent years, including in this year, from USA Today to Detroit papers, any number of papers across the country, small, medium size, and large. And most of them are either owned by public companies or private owners, not by billionaires. So I don't think that's why this is happening. And I want to push back on one other thing, which is that the idea that we have tempered our coverage of Bezos or his businesses or of anything because of Trump's threats. I think any fair look at our coverage will show that we have broken more stories about the about Trump's abuses and threats and his attempts to manipulate federal contracts and federal business than any other news organization. And I think Trump would agree with that, and I think Bezos would agree with that. And so we make it our business not to bend to our news coverage to Trump's threats. We've exposed his threats again and again. And while this, I think, is a difficult and dark chapter for the Post as far as this decision and the timing of it, I really think the evidence shows that that the institution has stood up to Trump's manipulation quite remarkably.
Well, and let me be clear that I don't mean to insinuate that either the Post or reporters or the editorial staff does not have the highest integrity. We've seen many people on your editorial board resign over this, and reporters resign over it too. I mean, I think you have great integrity. The thing that scares me the most is that I had a New York Times reporter on my podcast a few weeks ago, and he said that his big concern was that newspapers were struggling to stay alive, and his concern was that they would be pressured by advertisers, not by Trump. But he said basically, if you're getting full page ads from the National Rifle Association, are you going to run an article on gun violence? You know, or are you going to, not that you would stand up for the National Rifle Association, but would you pull back? And because newspapers, we all realize the Washington Post is getting smaller every time it gets delivered, and papers are going out of business right and left. My wife's a school librarian and laments the fact that we've all plugged into the internet and have stopped reading. So let me be clear about that. I have no problem with your integrity. I told you before we started, I followed you for years. I'm a big fan. Or the integrity of the editorial board of the Washington Post. It's just scary that, as you say, it's really his decision, and you know, and whether he's succumbing to pressure because of his fear that Trump will take over the federal government and there'll be the demise of the Post, or because he's just part of the billionaire boys club, I don't think it really matters much in the end. I think the thing is that you know, that we're all concerned about exactly the things that you've been so upfront about, and you know, I so appreciate that. And I guess there's really nothing we can do about this at this point except to, you know, try to stand by those of you who've had the courage to stand up. You know, we see the New York Times, Philadelphia Inquirer, New Yorker, Houston Chronicle, Boston Globe, Seattle Times, Las Vegas Sun, New York Post, and Washington Times, and even Las Vegas Review Journal have all endorsed. And I think, personally, I don't know that you wouldn't have lost more subscribers if you'd endorsed Trump, but for me personally, I would have felt better about it if there was some endorsement. So I think you've been very upfront and honest, so let's move on. I don't think there's much more that can be said about this other than, you know, the things that you've said, and thank you for your honesty. But you've also written co-authored a book called Trump Revealed, and I think the weekend before the election, I'd like to have your assessment, what you think of this man. Is he the misogynist that he appears to be, or is he just a brilliant campaigner?
Well, he's probably both. I wouldn't quite say that he's a brilliant campaigner, but he is a master marketer, and he has an extraordinary instinct for what will attract his following and what will get them excited and outraged and more on his side. And this is something that he's honed over the course of decades. What we write about in Trump Revealed, I mean, it's essentially a biography that goes back to his family's roots overseas all the way up to the present. And what's consistent about Trump through all the decades is that he has a very tangential relationship with the truth, and he believes that that's okay because it's all in the service of Trump. It's all in the service of enlarging his business and increasing his profits and enhancing his image. And so he learned at a very early age that you are your brand and that facts and laws and the other guardrails that govern people's behavior in our society don't really apply if you simply disregard them. And so I think it's tremendously frustrating to a lot of his opponents that all of the ordinary ways of holding someone to account don't seem to apply in Trump's case. And that's because he simply rejects the idea that you need to follow the law, that you need to follow the rules, that you must adhere to norms. He thinks those are just not for him. And I think we can all conclude at this point that he's right, that he does get away with virtually anything and everything. So whether it's the Access Hollywood tape, in which he talks about his ability to get away with abusing women, or his flaunting of the law and his real estate business, or in the presidency, this has really not resulted in bad consequences for him. And even when it does, he manages to get around them. This is a man who filed for bankruptcy 6 times. This is someone who's had literally dozens of businesses fail and yet manages to market himself to the people as a successful entrepreneur. So the system and our society were not built for people who were simply going to flaunt their violations of the law and of expectations. And so he is judged by a standard that is completely different from how we judge ordinary politicians. When ordinary politicians mess up and violate the law, even if it's simply a technicality, they are generally held to account. They are shamed. They are their misdeeds are publicized. They often lose their positions. But in Trump's case, none of that applies because we judge him mostly as a celebrity, more as a celebrity than as a politician. And I think we can all agree that there is a tendency in our society to forgive misdeeds by celebrities, sports figures, Hollywood figures, and so on. And Trump really kind of gets that by from his longstanding status as a celebrity on TV, in the movies, and wrestling, before he ever entered politics.
Well, you know, first of all, let me say that I'm the son of a con man. And so when I see Trump, I see my dad. My dad, we got to Washington because we ran away from New Jersey, where the authorities were after him for some of his cons. And I think you're very right about that. My dad had this ability to look into your eyes, directly into your eyes, and say, Mark, I'm going to take this money from you, but you're going to be the first to get it back, knowing that he was lying all the time. And people believed it because most people can't do that, Mark. Most people can't, you know, just sit there and bald-faced lie to you. And your comment really hits me because my dad used to drive like a maniac, and he owned a Cadillac. And if you said something to him, he would say, I own a Cadillac. I own more of the roads than everybody else because I paid more for my car. And that's what he believed. You know, that was back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, that was about as good as you can get. We didn't have a lot of Mercedes-Benz. So I think your analysis is, you know, spot on. And I just, it just scares me because I see him every time I see Trump. And yeah, I think you're right. We tend to forgive celebrities. But I got to say, I don't know if you're as astounded as I am, but my mother was a Republican precinct chairman. And after those comments he made on to the talk show host, the gossip columnist or the gossip reporter, she wouldn't have voted for him if God came down and told her to vote for him. So I guess I'm amazed at that. Do you have any insight at the Washington Post? I haven't seen the latest polls, but any insight in how the campaign's going? Is it really as close, do you think, as they say it, as the polls seem to suggest?
Yeah, I think the polls at this point are fairly useless simply because the margins of error are larger than the difference between the candidates. So all the polls are really able to tell us at this point is how close it is and some of the factors that are driving people's votes. We had an interesting story in the Post today about women who are pro-abortion rights and yet Trump supporters. And it was quite a significant percentage of women who are in favor of abortion rights who are voting for Trump. So that kind of drives a stake into one of the major premises of the Harris campaign.
Right.
But you can find those sorts of insights in the polls, but when a race is this close, they're not very useful, especially in the kind of larger beauty contest findings about the national popular vote, which, as we know, is not how presidents get elected. So where's the race right now? I think it's turning out to be what a lot of folks thought it would be at the beginning of the year, which is a turnout election. People have had their minds made up for a long time, and then the question is how many people who are not customary voters are actually going to come out, and how good are each of the campaigns about getting them out. If you're a Harris supporter, you could take heart in the fact that she has a much more widespread and deeply embedded turnout operation, get out the vote operation around the country, and that would seem to be a strike in her favor. On the other hand, Trump has focused his operations on bringing out people who don't ordinarily vote. That was the secret to his 2016 win. He brought out a lot of people who don't ordinarily vote, and a lot of those are not reflected in polling because polls are weighted toward people who can demonstrate that they voted in the previous few elections and have a track record of voting. You know, young men seem to be turning to Trump in larger numbers than they did in his last two races. And he's also drawing a higher percentage of black and Hispanic voters than he did in his previous races. So all of that seems to lean in his direction. But he's reliant on a lot more people who don't ordinarily vote. And so for him to win, he's got to actually get them to the polls. And that can take a lot of organization and a lot of logistical help. It's not entirely clear whether he's got that.
Well, and you know what? That surprises me, too. I got to tell you, I was at the Democratic convention where I was a superdelegate, and my daughter grabbed me by the back of the pants and pulled me away from a Trump supporter. They were filming me, and I just couldn't take it. I walked by a young black man with a big Trump sign, and I turned around to him, and I said, "You know, he doesn't like black people, right?" And the kids, it just astounds me that black people stand up for this man with some of the things he said about people of color. But let me ask you, do you think there's any chance now if Harris wins the popular vote and loses like Clinton did and others have in recent past, could this be the end of the Electoral College?
I don't see it. I mean, you know, it's a 50-50 evenly divided country.
Right.
To bring about a change, a constitutional change like that, would require, much larger majority, two-thirds
right.
majority. And it's hard to get a two-thirds majority in this country about anything, let alone a major change in the constitutional structure of how we choose presidents and conduct elections. So in addition to which, there's a lot of support for the Electoral College, and it's interesting to me that a lot of the opponents of that system are people who are generally very much in favor of minority rights. Well, there's no greater guarantee of minority rights in our Constitution than the Electoral College, which protects the rights of small states, less populated states, and gives them a voice in a system that otherwise would be simply run by the largest group of voters. So it's, you know, the rules of our elections have been clear and set for centuries, and for one side to say, hey, this is unfair, it seems to me a bit precious, because everyone knows the rules. We don't elect presidents by popular vote. We elect them by state. And so if you have a message that appeals to people in a lot of states, you're going to have a lot better chance in the election. Whereas the Democrats have increasingly focused their appeal to college-educated people who tend to live on the coasts, and that diminishes the number of states that their message is attractive in. And so it's no surprise, shouldn't be any surprise, that that they're at a disadvantage in the Electoral College.
Let me ask you, too, that, you know, I'm one of the few Democrats that I've heard say this, but I went right after Hillary Clinton lost. I went to a thing to speak to people, and I had a woman stand up and say to me, as Democrats, we have nothing to apologize for. And I said, don't be ridiculous. This man wouldn't have gotten elected if we had been doing our job. So how much of a role do you think Democrats play? You know, how have we lost the traditional groups that we've had, right? How as a billionaire, I'm a former Teamster, first decent job I ever had, and how does a billionaire convince the head of the Teamsters Union to, for the first time, to come and speak on his behalf, and how does he convince working people that he knows their pain? Isn't that an abdication of our responsibility as Democrats to get our message out there, or what do you think?
Well, it's a question not only of getting the message out there, but of having a message that is genuinely appealing and feels authentic to voters who are in a very rough spot. Voters are, Americans are having trouble affording the basics in life. They're having trouble saving anything for their retirement. They're having trouble getting housing. Housing prices are generally beyond reach for most people at this point. Obviously, food and other basics are out of reach for all too many people. And what you're seeing in the support for Trump through now three elections is a very clear statement that we are being looked down upon, we the American people are being looked down upon by our leaders, particularly the Democrats, who seem to cater to the wealthier, more college-educated, urban populations, and look down upon the bulk of Americans. We saw it this week with President Biden's comment about how Trump supporters are garbage, and whether you know he can now try to backtrack all he wants. The fact is, when we hear that, and when we hear Hillary Clinton's line about the deplorables, there is an attitude, a disdain, a snideness about people who are less educated, people who work with their hands, people who don't live in big cities. And when you go out to Trump rallies, sure, there's the hardcore Trump supporters who just are angry and full of rage and all of that, but the bulk of the people there are either Obama-Trump voters or people who have previously voted for Democrats, who considered themselves Democrats for many years and feel so alienated because of the language and the rhetoric of Democrats. And you see these messages from Trump that are superficially ridiculous, whether it's attacking transgender people or going on about the use of pronouns. But those hit home because a lot of Americans are saying, who are you people to tell me how to talk? who are you people to tell me what I have to do? And there is an arrogance that emanates from the Democratic message that I think is tremendously hurting their ability to win national elections.
I got to tell you something, Mark. I've asked that question to everybody that's been on the show, and that's relevant to the issue, and that's the most honest answer I've ever gotten. I felt this for years because I was a working class kid. I was an orphan, and I came to work at Democratic National Committee for 3 years and really felt like I was in the wrong, you know, that I snuck in the back door because of exactly what you talk about. And that's right. I think we tell women if you want to be stay at home and raise children, you know, you're not actualizing your potential. You have to have a college education. You have to. I think we've talked down to America so long that this is really like the French who threw their shoes into the machinery, right? That people wanna sabotage the system. They want to shake it up. They want to say. Yeah, and they think this man will do it. I think that's just such an honest answer. And as a member, as an elected official, and a member of the most pusillanimous profession in the world, we're for whatever the wind blows in whatever direction. I'm not sanctimonious about it, but I think that you're absolutely right. We've talked down to America for so long that we've lost these people. I often say I was born a Democrat because I was orphaned, been working full-time since I was 15 years old, lied about my age, got full-time jobs, was a high school dropout, was a teamster, was a, you know, pulled myself up by my own bootstraps. But you know, I didn't see any alternative when I started, when I voted for the first time. I was one of the six people that voted for George McGovern for president. We were so shocked, you know. I was part of that first 18-year-old class that voted, and we were sure that Richard Nixon was going down. And then we read the newspaper the next day, and it was one of the most significant losses, I think, in election history. But I think the Democratic Party is not what they say the Republican Party is not the Republican Party of old, and I believe that. I believe that Barry Goldwaters and Bob Doles and people like that no longer exist in the Republican Party. But I also feel that about the Democrats too. And I think you've been one of the most honest people I've ever had on the show, and I want to thank you for that. Let me know. I know you're busy. If you need to go, let me know. But please tell us whatever you want to say that I haven't asked you. I really want to know because I think you're an amazing journalist.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. We are in a time of party realignment, and the definitions of what a Democrat is and what a Republican is are shifting before our eyes. And obviously, the Republican Party is no longer a strictly conservative one. They barely, if ever, talk about cutting federal spending or balancing the budget or those sort of strong Republican core foundational positions that they'd held for decades. That seems to have just gone out the window. In addition to which, the Republicans were always the more internationalist party, and that seems to be completely reversed. Democrats as well, we see them turning away from their roots in many ways. And, you mentioned both George McGovern and Barry Goldwater, opposite ends of the ideological spectrum, yeah. And yet both of them were kind of populist in their messages. They both appealed to a bunch of people in the country who felt frustrated and angry and didn't like the way the system was working and wanted some basic elemental change. They wanted obviously very different changes, but nonetheless, that was their appeal. we haven't seen that much from Democrats lately, and we've left it to Trump to be the populist. There used to be a strong Democratic tradition of populism, whether it was right. Hubert Humphrey or before that, after that, George McGovern, and that's why Democrats were able to build coalitions that included blue-collar workers and the people who we now think of as Trump followers. So the Democrats need to actually regain that ability to appeal to blue-collar workers and to people who are not college-educated, or else they are destined to remain a minority party. That has solid support in New York and California, but in other coastal states, but really no appeal in the middle of the country.
Yeah, and that's very sad. And I hope that the realignment takes place soon in both parties, because I think we both need to find our souls again. But let me ask you one last question, because this has just occurred to me. I just got back 2 days ago from an international conference in Brazil for an organization I'm involved in. And there were people from all over the world. I think 40 countries were represented. And we were there to talk about how Brazil could integrate better into the world and expand, especially in South America. But for me, nobody wanted to talk about anything I prepared so much for this, except Donald Trump. The world, I can tell you, is terrified at this. Now, these were mostly liberal people, but they're all terrified that he's going to get elected and what that's going to mean to international relationships and policies. What do you think? You think this will, does he hurt us internationally?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you're absolutely right. I'm continually amazed by the level of interest and knowledge and involvement in other countries about the American election. Regularly get calls from news organizations in Britain and Sweden and South America and so on, wanting to learn more about what is going on in the American elections. And they do that in part because they look up to us for moral leadership, but also there's economic dependence that they have on us, and they want stability. Their economies are very much based on the idea that the American economy will be stable, the American dollar will be stable. Many countries in the world, increasing numbers, use the dollar as their currency. And so as we go, so go their fortunes. So they're deeply concerned, and they're deeply frightened that Trump will remove or pull America away from its international obligations and involvements. And they saw that happen to some extent in his first term, and they fear that that would be much more severe in a second term.
Yeah, and I must say that I'm concerned, because I talk to Trump people all the time, and you know, I've seen the rise in things like protectionism and, you know, with this tariff idea. And I've heard many people say we should, on Trump's side, that we should pull out of Ukraine and stop giving money to, you know, which just amazes me that we would go back to a policy of isolationism. And so I think you're very right. But Mark Fisher, I know you're very, very busy, so I'm going to let you go. But let me say that I don't know what I'm going to do about my subscription to the Post, but either way, if the Post goes down, wherever you go, Mark, I will follow you. I think you're an amazing columnist. I hope that you express to everybody on the editorial staff that you know that we, many of us, stand with you, and we admire your courage and your ability to stand up and speak frankly and honestly about what's going on. So thank you, Mark Fisher, for being on our show, and I hope I get to talk to you again.
That'd be great, and I would just encourage people to consider holding on to their Post subscriptions or even subscribing anew to support the investigative work that reporters and editors are doing, which they are doing, as Bob Woodward once said, all good work is done in defiance of management. And so if you want to support that defiance, you got to subscribe.
Well, you convinced me, and I hope you've convinced others. And thanks again, Mark, for being on the show. I look forward to talking to you in the future.
Thank you.
All right. Folks, we're going to take a brief pause here while we regroup a little bit. But let me just say how important I think it is. I'm going to give you my pitch. We were going to have some call-ins today, but we decided instead that it was more important to talk to Mark. And obviously, if you've been listening to the show, you know that's true. He's really been straightforward and honest with us. But this is my last plug for going out and being part of this election. You know, I truly believe that the old saying that we hippies, I'm an old hippie, developed during the 1960s, which if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. So we all have to be part of the solution. We all have to go out there and vote. And I don't mean mail in your ballot. I don't mean show up at the polls. I mean call your aunts and uncles and tell the postman and anybody you know that you've got to go out there and vote. You've got to express your opinion. This is how we feed our democracy. I hope you'll vote for Kamala Harris. I think that she's a good candidate with her heart in the right place. I hope you will remember the sacrifice that Joe Biden has made. President Biden may have said the wrong thing the other day, but let's not forget that he had the nomination in his pocket. You need, I can't remember how many delegates you need off the top of my head, but he had many, many, many more than he needed. There was no way for anyone else to be the Democratic nominee except for him unless he stepped down. And he stepped down. He stepped down because he knew it was in the best interest of America. And we all need to go out there and do the absolute, what's absolutely in the best interest for America. And Donald Trump would not step down. He would not step aside. He will not do anything for you. And I've got to tell you, it astounds me when I hear Mark talk about how women who believe in a woman's right to choose would stand up for Trump. He is really the Republican Party right now. There are so many states where women cannot already get the health care they need because of what's going on in the Republican Party. All those people that stood up for this man in Congress and his election fraud claims, which have all been debunked, knew that he lost the election. Every member of Congress that stood up for him on the Republican side is nothing more than a coward. There was not one of those people that didn't understand he lost. And I can tell you what, Donald Trump knew he lost too. God bless Adam Kinzinger. God bless Liz Cheney for having the courage to go against their party. Mark Fisher, the other people from the editorial board of the Washington Post who have stood up against Bezos' interference in what should be a fair and independent news source. You know, the on top of the editorial page, where I've had 21 of my opinion pieces published, it says an independent newspaper. You know, I think, which I tweeted out, I think that Jeff Bezos needs to Google the word independent. Because when you interfere with the transmission of frank and honest news, you're not independent. And so let's hope that we can pressure him to put the independence back in the Washington Post. Let's consider, you know, what we can do. And Mark's right. Resigning, or getting rid of our subscriptions is really hurts all the people that work there. And I live in Washington, D.C., and I could tell you a lot of people work for the Post. And they're not just the people that do the reporting and are on the editorial pages. They're the people that print the newspaper. They're the people that drive the trucks. I was a post paper boy at 12 years old. My family needed money, and it was the one job I could get. So you're going to put little paper boys out of business. You're going to put truck drivers out of business. You're going to put printers out of business. You're going to put their electronic people out of business if we put them out of business. So let's try to be supportive and find other ways that we can show our dissatisfaction to the Post. I'm going to work on that, and I hope you'll work on that. And we're going to end our show a little early today because Mark has said everything that needs to be said, I think, on the issue. And I've made my final pitch. Vote, vote, vote. It's the way we feed our democracy. It's what makes America great. And let me tell you, just to finish, that I just came from a conference in Brazil which brought people from all around the world, and we are that shining light on the hill that Ronald Reagan talked about. We are still a beacon of democracy to the world, and we need to remain that, not only for the health of America, but for the health of the planet. You know what? We cannot ignore the recent storms in North Carolina and Florida and Louisiana and all across America. We can't ignore that Florida is sinking into the ocean and California's on fire. So when you got a man that's saying, drill, baby, drill, it's time to say, no, baby, no. Go out, vote for Kamala Harris. She's our best choice. If you think she's not perfect, okay, maybe she's not. But certainly, she's a choice that America needs to make to stay the great country we are. We don't need to make America great again. We've always been great. Let's continue to be great. Please vote. Now, we close our show every week with a song usually dedicated to our guests because I'm a big music freak. But this goes out to Jeff Bezos and the people at the Washington Post that thinks perhaps that he made the right decision. This is Tom Petty with I Won't Back Down. Get a backbone, Jeff. Tune in next week, folks. Thanks, and vote.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.